Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, August 28, 2024, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Mizza is out and about. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprouts. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live and Instagram Live episode at Fran Storch ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Okay, so update on me. I had kind of a sad weekend because I'm off the bike again. I woke up on Saturday morning pretty exhausted after two long days of work. I'm still treating my, I'm taking a lot of lime herbs. So who knows if it's because, you know, combination of stressing myself by working a lot and also taking the lime herbs, but I have to take lime herbs. I have to take them for a long time. So I have good days and bad days, and I had not such a good day on Saturday, although it was good enough that I was able to meet the bike group at the rest stop. And the rest stop was, shout out to Kara and Brutus, the Hampton General store. So that was fun going over there and seeing everybody, but I wasn't able to ride my bike that day. And then as I was walking around, I started to feel a little sore on the inside of my right knee again. And then today I realized, yep, that right knee is pinched out. It's not extremely painful, but it's painful enough that when I step on it wrong or move it the wrong way, it does hurt. So we're off the bike again, and we're off the bike until I don't know when. So I have to manage the knee again. I have to make decisions. I have to rest, ice, compress, take anti-inflammatories, do whatever exercises I can, modify any exercises that I do. We made the decision that it wasn't a good idea for me to get on the bike today either, even though we were going to go very short and slow. I got on the trainer for 10 minutes and then got off and realized that I had more pain. So can't do it. So no riding until it's not so acute. So I have to manage it. And then of course the thing is always, let's see how long this lasts. I'm trying to manage it conservatively. Most of the time a meniscus can be managed conservatively. And if it doesn't get better, then off to the orthopedist and have an opinion there. At this point, should I be considering surgery or not? Surgery is not advised if you can avoid it, because a meniscus can heal. And mine keeps healing. I'm off it for a little while and then I'm back on it. But it keeps happening and it's annoying. And I just want to be able to be physically active. And it's very frustrating for me to not be physically active. And so I had a very good acupuncture appointment on Friday evening after those two long days of work. I felt pretty good. And then Nicole and I talked about, is there a Chinese herbal formula I could take to help me with various things, including tremors and including my blood pressure, because my blood pressure is still rising in at a level that I'm not comfortable with. And she said yes. So she offered me a Chinese herbal formula. And when I looked at the indications for the Chinese herbal formula, it really fits me and it does help things. It helps with liver fire rising. When liver fire gets excessively into your head, or liver blood gets excessively into your head, it helps to keep that down and push it back down. The formula is called Qianma Gu Ten Ying, and she uses it. When I asked Nicole what the indications were for, she said it's a general harmonizing formula. So I was interested in knowing what specifics it was good for, and it was good for a lot of the things I have going on, for a lot of liver excess. That's a Chinese term, but it's definitely good for hypertension. She gives it to her patients who have blood pressure issues, and it also happens to be good for tremors. So that's great. So I feel pretty grounded. She gave me a powder, which I am to put in hot water, and I take it the same way as the Limerita, which means 2 hours after eating, or half an hour before. So I can take it first thing in the morning when I take my lime herbs. It's best taken as a hot tea. I don't know if that's going to happen all the time, because it's hard for me rushing getting ready in the morning to sit down and drink a cup of hot tea. Also, I have to get those lime herbs on board and then wait half an hour before I ingest anything else. So if I have to sit and drink hot tea, it takes time to drink hot tea. I do enjoy drinking it as a hot tea, I must say. And the flavor of this tea, you know, when you get Chinese herbal formulas, it's not going to be something that you're used to drinking. This one isn't bad if you don't mind herby taste. It tastes very earthy. What it reminds me of is twig tea. If you ever had twig tea or kukicha tea, same thing. Or even Chinese oolong tea. It kind of tastes like oolong. It tastes more like twig / kukicha tea, which is, you know, black tea that's been partially fermented. And when you drink twig tea, instead of drinking tea made from the leaves, you're drinking the sticks. So it has a more earthy, herbal flavor than green tea or white tea. And that's what it kind of tastes like. And it's pleasant. It's not, I would say that the Tulsi tea that I drink every night with my supplements, which is also a lovely calming tea, is more bitter than this tea. And Nicole said to me, if you don't care for the flavor of it, you can enhance it by putting ginger in. And ginger just tastes really good. And I love ginger. And I thought ginger would be fun to add, but I didn't need to do it. I mean, it might be fun to put the ginger in and just make it taste more interesting, but it tastes fine without it. So I'm happy to drink it the way it is. And I'm happy to drink it hot, even though I usually drink cold beverages. It's getting to be that time of year where you're starting to think about fall, and we are getting cool nights now. We're getting nights down in the 50s and 60s. And so first thing in the morning, a cup of something hot is not bad right now. I'm also noticing, you know, that eating soup is a good thing to eat any time of year. And when you haven't had it for a long time and all you've been having is cold vegetables and fruit and salads, having soup is a nice thing. So this is my shot. I'm hoping that this will help my blood pressure. And if it doesn't, I had a nice chat with my colleague and friend, Sean Brady, who is, he's a holistically oriented cardiological physician's assistant. And he knows all about supplements for heart issues, and he knows all about cardiology. So I texted with him and we talked about, should I try taking a med once again? So if it comes down to it, I will probably try taking a med. When I had taken olmesartan in the past, olmesartan is an ARB, an angiotensin receptor antagonist. I had taken that in the past at a very low dose. And the second day I had took it, I woke up in the middle of the night and nearly passed out. So unfortunately, blood pressure medicines, they drop your blood pressure and they don't care what's going on in your body. It's a pharmacological event. So blood pressure medicines can make you dizzy. That's just what they do. So I'm nervous to take any blood pressure medicine because I can't afford to get dizzy. And I get dizzy easily because I'm on that edge of having POTS. I think I'm mostly okay with it. When I'm not feeling well, I have orthostatic intolerance. But I'm fortunate that my pulse tends to run on the low side, which is great. And my resting pulse is in the 50s and 60s, which is fine. So I'm not tachycardic. I don't have a fast heartbeat, naturally. But as it is, if I'm not feeling well, I get that orthostatic intolerance where I stand up, I don't feel good. I don't get a racing heart, but I just don't feel well. And so if I get something that enhances my ability to feel faint, that's a bad thing. And so that's what makes me very nervous to take a blood pressure med, because once you're on the blood pressure med, you aren't able to regulate your blood pressure. Blood pressure is just kept down regardless of what you might need. So if your blood pressure need your blood pressure to rise because you're standing up, it might not go there and you won't get enough circulation to your head and then you feel faint. That's how it works. What happened was when I went to the Hampton General Store, I discovered that at least three people who were in the parking lot, you know, who were at the Hampton General Store enjoying the store, had ridden their bikes there a distance. None of the people I talked to, well, that's not true. One of the people that I talked to had ridden the shorter distance, which was 33 miles, and he's on lisinopril with hydrochlorothiazide. Another fellow was also on lisinopril with hydrochlorothiazide. And I'm like, how are these people athletes and taking a diuretic? Hydrochlorothiazide is a diuretic, but they're also on lisinopril. And that's working for them. They just stay hydrated and they don't get dehydrated. And I asked one of the fellas, do you get dehydrated from taking this? And he says, not if I drink water. I just have to make sure I drink water. I will make sure that I drink water right now. Mm. Delicious. Okay. So, and the other fella that I talked to was on benazepril. So any blood pressure medicine that ends in pril is an ACE inhibitor, angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitor. So the olmesartan I took was an ARB, an angiotensin receptor antagonist. They work in the same system, but in slightly different ways. So you have the renin-angiotensin system. Renin is produced by your kidneys. Renin gets converted by angiotensin-converting enzyme to angiotensin 1, which then gets converted again by angiotensin-converting enzyme to angiotensin 2, which then gets converted to aldosterone. Aldosterone holds on to sodium, pulls sodium back into your system, which then holds on to water, because as my beloved late teacher Anna McIntosh said, the kidneys want their water, and they will do what they can to hold on to water for you. So you subvert that by taking hydrochlorothiazide. Hydrochlorothiazide goes into the loops and makes it so that you release more water, but you release a lot more minerals and sodium and other minerals along with it. And angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors inhibit the enzyme that converts angiotensin 1 to 2 and 2 to aldosterone. So when you have less aldosterone, you don't hold on to your sodium, you release more water, and your blood pressure comes down. So it works at the level of the angiotensin-converting enzyme. ARBs work in the same system, but instead of blocking the enzyme directly, they work at the level of the receptors of angiotensin-converting enzyme. So it's an angiotensin receptor blocker. So it blocks angiotensin. It blocks the receptor for angiotensin to bond for the converting enzyme to bond on angiotensin. That's how it works. So it's a little. It interrupts the same pathway, but just by a different mechanism. And you know, these things affect your kidneys. Both drugs can increase your sodium. Or, I'm sorry, they can both increase your potassium. They will deplete your sodium, but they can increase your potassium. So you have to be careful how much potassium you consume. So you don't take potassium pills when you take these. And they can make you dizzy. Any drug that lowers your blood pressure can make you dizzy, unfortunately. So I'm very nervous to take these. I know that I took that olmesartan and I got dizzy on the second day. Maybe I wouldn't get dizzy every day, but I just can't afford to be dizzy. Meanwhile, I've been taking this Tianma Guotianying, and I have not gotten dizzy. I feel fine while I'm taking it. When I had taken the Ayurvedic formula that has a norepinephrine depleter in it, Rauwolfia, that didn't make me dizzy either. But it also didn't lower my blood pressure enough. So it's concerning to me because I don't want to have high blood pressure and I have a genetic problem. I'm taking a lot of herbs and supplements that help to lower blood pressure. My blood pressure is still not low. And, you know, some of it is stress, but some of it is genetics because both my mother and my sister, they're not working currently. My mother's retired and my sister is a stay-at-home mom and they are both on meds for blood pressure. It's genetic. And it could be that I have a level of excitation anxiety that produces high blood pressure, and it could be that I do not have elastic blood vessels, and I'm voting for the not so elastic blood vessels because I see patients all the time who are very stressed and have absolutely normal blood pressure. I have anxious, stressed, upset patients. I take their blood pressure and it's perfect. So I think there's something genetically about how the way our blood pressure, our blood vessels are formed, that our blood vessels are just, they are just not as elastic as they should be. Even though I'm taking things, I'm taking resveratrol and I'm taking vitamin C, I'm taking magnesium to calm them down. I'm taking olive leaf. I'm taking black cumin seed oil and fish oil, which helps with the integrity of the cell membranes. And still, blood pressure still high. I wonder if it'd be higher if I wasn't taking the things that I'm taking. And of course, I do yin yoga pretty much every day. And even the yin and restorative yoga isn't enough to calm it down. So you get to a point where you're like sick of looking at the numbers, taking your blood pressure and seeing it rise. And of course, if you worry about your blood pressure, it gets higher. It's getting to the point where I get concerned because the problem with the first thing you worry about with high blood pressure is, are you going to have a stroke? And the thing is, I know that when I'm sitting at the office, I'm sitting with patients, I'm very active and I'm excited talking to the patients, my blood pressure goes up because I take it at the end of the day and it's higher than it is at other times of the day. If I'm in a day where I'm mostly relaxed, I'm not seeing patients, I will have blood pressures where it's one th- in the 130s in the 80s, which is not so bad for me. But it's hard. I can't seem to get into the 120s and the below 80 without help. So what I was pleased to see is that my three friends who were all in ACE inhibitors, nobody was on an ARB. Everybody was on either just an ACE inhibitor or an ACE inhibitor with a diuretic. They all had ridden there and were very happy and were not having side effects. And they're just, one of the fellows is a tall, slender man who's a very industrious fellow. And he was shocked that with his lifestyle and diet that he needed a blood pressure med. But there it was. And so he's taking it. And that's great because his wife loves him and wants him around. And this is true of the other two guys as well. So they're taking those drugs successfully and they're able to enjoy their bike. So that was encouraging to me. And it made me wonder, should I try the ACE inhibitor rather than another ARB? The olmesartan, the thing with olmesartan is it works well, which is part of the problem for me. I may be very sensitive to those medications, so I need something that's a little less potent. So I talked it over with Sean, and he suggested if you want to take an ARB, maybe you should consider losartan. And losartan is the least potent of the ARBs. And so he calls it, he had a nastier word for it, a more deprecating word for it, because it doesn't have a long half-life. It doesn't work that great. But because I'm sensitive, it might work well for me. As you know, when I take caffeine, a little goes a long way. So maybe with these drugs, a little will go a long way. And I would start with a very low dose of lisinopril if I took it. I'd start with 2.5 milligrams, which is the lowest you can get, I believe. And if I were to start with losartan, whatever the absolute lowest baby dose is, that's what I would start with as well. Although it didn't work out so well with olmesartan. The other thing I could do, which I could have done with the olmesartan, is take it on alternate days. But we'll see. If the drugs have a shorter half-life, then I can take it every day and probably be okay. It is possible that with the longer half-life of olmesartan, I took it 2 days in a row and it just overwhelmed me. And I might be okay if I took it on alternate days. So that's something to think about too. I have the olmesartan here. I could take it and then just take it on alternate days. That's a thought. And people do that. People do creative things. I do believe in using pharmaceuticals in a way that works for you. And I wouldn't recommend you trying this on your own. I would recommend if you have a pharmaceutical and you don't feel good on it, talk to your physician, whoever prescribed it to you, about doing a different dosing schedule. Doesn't matter what it is. If it's a blood pressure med or a statin or I would say that for psychiatric meds, if you're taking something for anxiety and depression, you may have to continue to take it every day. But something like a blood pressure med, especially if you're sensitive to it and you get dizzy, maybe you need a lower dose or maybe you can take it on alternate days. And that would be a way to go. So, and I believe in doing that. So anyway, but I don't believe in you going and doing something because I said so. Remember, we have a disclaimer here that this is not medical advice. This is education. And when you see or me say something, you should then go and check it out with your practitioner. And especially with a pharmaceutical med that somebody prescribed to you, you need to go talk to the person that prescribed it to you before you make any changes. So that's what's going on there. I'm waiting for my knee to heal and I'm figuring out if this neat stuff, this tea, is going to help me lower my blood pressure. I may get it in pills it comes in pills as well. I might try to take it in pills. The tea is lovely. I really don't mind taking the tea. It's just, it's pricier and it is also, it's not convenient. It's okay if I'm not working, if I don't have anything going on, but to sit and drink a cup of hot tea, on a day when I'm rushing off to be at the office, when I get up with just enough time to get my exercise in, get myself washed and showered and out the door, I have to down any medicines quickly. So I make the tea at night and then drink it cold the next day. That's just what I'm going to have to do unless it's a day where I can sit down and enjoy it. If I have something going on first thing in the morning, that's not going to work. So anyway, we'll see how this works. It has to work in a way that works for me. And if it doesn't work out, then I have to go on to the next thing. So that's what's going on with my health and blood pressure. If you're interested, I am still taking other things for my blood pressure, like amla herb, which is an Ayurvedic herb that helps with blood pressure. It's supposed to have ARB, angiotensin receptor blocker activity. None of the stuff I'm taking is making me dizzy. I'm taking hawthorn solid extract. I'm taking magnesium, both magnesium glycinate malate as well as magnesium, just magnesium citrate. I could be taking magnesium taurate or magnesium orotate, both of which are supposed to be more helpful for blood pressure, and that is something I could switch to. So I'm not taking that supplement that contains magnesium, I'm just taking separate magnesium. I am taking nervine herbs. I'm taking cactus, which is not a nervine, but it is a general cardiotonic. I am taking passion flower. I'm taking American skullcap, Scutellaria lateriflora. I'm taking linden. So these are all nervine herbs that help to keep you calm. Once in a while, I will pop a L-theanine. Once in a while, I'll pop CBD, cannabidiol. But none of these things are successfully bring my blood pressure to where I want it to be, which would be 120 over 80 or less. I would settle for the 120s or the 80s, but I can't seem to get there without help. So that's what's going on there. All right. So the next thing I wanted to talk about, we were talking about dental health, and the last thing I wanted to talk about with dental health was dental floss, because remember we were talking about how toothbrushes are made of plastic, and toothbrushes have plastic bristles. So when you brush them, of course they deteriorate, and you're getting little bits of plastic in your mouth. And that never occurred to me that when you brush your teeth, you can be getting microplastics from the toothbrush, because the toothbrush, you're brushing it against your enamel, and little tiny micro bits of it are going to come off. So it's another way they get microplastics in your body. So wouldn't it be better to have a toothbrush that wasn't made of plastic? And you can get toothbrushes that are biodegradable, they're compostable, and they're made of bamboo. So they have a bamboo stick, and they have a bamboo, they have bamboo bristles. So I got a box of those. So I'm using those now. So my whole life I've been using plastic toothbrushes, never even thought about it until one day I saw somebody online selling bamboo toothbrushes, and I thought, that really makes sense. So I got to thinking about the dental floss. Guess what? Same thing. Dental floss, when you use dental floss, you're using substances. If you look at Consumer Reports and you look at the Environmental Working Group, they talk about dental floss, and dental floss is usually made of plastic as well. It can be made of polyester. It can be made of other plastics. And again, you could be getting little bits of plastic off in your mouth when you are using the floss. Now, if you rinse your mouth after you use your dental floss, you might be okay. But most dental floss is made of plastics. A lot of dentists like expanding floss. So what happens is it's still polyester, but it's woven polyester, and when you put it between your teeth, it expands. So it's going to pick up more stuff between your teeth. It's going to pick up more plaque and food debris and bacteria, whatever is in there. But it is made of polyester. If you do water flossing, of course, is a great way to go because it's not plastic. The only thing is that the water flosser itself is a whole plastic compartment. And so the water, the spout that you're spurting the water into your mouth with, and the chamber that the water sits in, that's all plastic as well. So are you getting some microplastics that way? It is possible. You're not breaking off bits of plastic directly like you are with the toothbrush or the dental floss. So, and my dentist is not a fan of exclusively water flossing. So I floss with floss, I use a rubber pick, and I water floss, especially at night before bed. And then after I'm done with all that, I do a rinse. And I rinse with an antimicrobial rinse that has all kinds of herbs in it, neem and tea tree oil and horse chestnut and coenzyme Q10. So it's a disinfecting, and mint. There's menthol in it as well. So it makes your mouth really nice and fresh. And then I seal it off. I've talked to you about this before, with a hydroxyapatite containing toothpaste that I leave on my teeth. I spread it on my teeth and leave it there. And so that the hydroxyapatite will seal up any beginning cavities and the lacunae, the little tubules in your teeth that have access to your nerves. So it stops those up so that bacteria is less likely to get in. And you do that. It's good to do that at least once a day so that you have protection. If you do it twice a day, even better. So dental floss as well doesn't have to be plastic. You can get dental floss that's made of bamboo. And use that rubber tip. Rubber tips hopefully are made of actual rubber, and rubber, if it's real rubber, rubber is tapped from trees, and it's not plastic, and it's non-toxic. So that's something you can use as well. So that's what I want to say about, so a little bit about high blood pressure, a little bit about dental floss, and let's get on to weight loss and those popular drugs. So that was the big thing I've been leading up to for a long time, finally getting a chance to talk about it. All right, so the thinking on weight loss in the conventional medical community is changing, or has changed. Because of the epidemic of overweight and obesity in the United States, many medical practitioners are looking at these conditions as disease states and not just something that occurs as a result of too much food and not enough exercise. It's true that you can have a variety of people on the same diet and some will lose weight and some will gain and some will maintain their weight. But the trend now is to medicalize obesity and treat it as a disease that has medical solutions. And I wanted to talk about some of the medical solutions. So the thing is it really true? Because, say, when you take a GLP-1 agonist, like your the various drugs, your semaglutides, your various incarnations of semaglutide, which would be your Wegovy, your Rybelsus, your Ozempic, those are all GLP-1 agonists. In GLP-1 agonists, they reduce your appetite, they increase your insulin sensitivity, they do a number of things, they make you feel, they increase your satiety, and meaning that you feel full sooner. So they do a variety of things that will help you with weight loss. But what one of the things that they're doing is they're making it so you eat less food. So wouldn't it be better if you just ate less food? I was watching Bill Maher interviewing Jillian Michaels. Remember Jillian Michaels? She's the personal trainer who was on The Biggest Loser for a number of years, and she was a real cracker of the whip. Anyway, she presented very nicely on Bill Maher. She was very, very sweet, but very forthright in her opinion, which is that these drugs, they work for you. It's kind of like taking osteoporosis drugs. They work for you for maybe 6 years, and then they stop working. People plateau, so you have to change doses, and the way that they have you lose weight is you do lose weight, but you also lose collagen and you also lose muscle mass. And that's why there's that Ozempic face where your face gets skinny and drawn and looks aged. It's because you're losing the items that plump up your face. And so anything that makes your face appear younger, that tissue goes away. So you're taking a chance when you take those drugs. So it's interesting that that weight loss has become medicalized. Before I talk about directly about the GLP-1 agonist, let me talk to you about bariatric surgery, because bariatric surgery is another medical procedure that people use. And I think what is happening is it happens in my practice too. It's very hard to lose weight. You really have to change your diet and your lifestyle drastically. And it still may not work. You still may not lose very much weight. And I don't know how much of it is people aren't actually changing very much, or that they are barely eating and they're still not losing weight. I'm not sure which it is. I know if I eat somewhat less, I will lose some weight. It is much harder for me to do than it was 20 years ago, because I'm a postmenopausal 60-year-old lady. And when you're my age, it's much harder to lose weight. When you're postmenopausal, you don't have your estrogen and progesterone helping to keep your muscle mass on board and helping you to produce, to push that hormone-sensitive lipase that helps you to burn fat. So at my age, it's very difficult. Again, there are probably some things I could do. If I lower my carbs more than I have right now, I would probably at least be a few pounds lighter. And on the other hand, I do eat a lot of fiber. I do like eat a lot of produce and protein, and I'm not obese. I am overweight. I'm at my BMI is in the overweight range, but I am not obese. And, you know, at my age, I'll take it. In order for me to not take a drug and not do bariatric surgery, I would have to drastically reduce my carbs and I would have to not have stress. And right now, not having stress is very difficult for me because my job is stressful. I do a lot of stress-reducing activities, and stress-reducing activities can help you be at a lower weight, and we'll explain that in a little bit. So let's go on to bariatric surgery first and talk about what that is. Bariatric surgery is surgery that you do to lose weight. And so here are the surgical procedures that you might have done. So first of all, bariatric surgery is any kind of surgery that you get, whether it's reducing the size of your stomach, whether you get a lap band procedure where they put a band around your stomach to decrease its volume, or they actually do a Roux-en-Y where they cut away most of your stomach and attach your esophagus to a small pouch that is made from your intestine. So they just basically remove your stomach. So you don't, and it works not just because you don't have a stomach and you have easier satiety. It's because there are hormones and receptors in your stomach that are no longer present that make it so you don't feel you have higher satiety. Satiety is, and remember, satiety is a word that means you feel satiated, you feel full. And when you have good satiety, you're not going to eat as much. And so bariatric surgery provides that because it's shrinking the size of your stomach or taking the stomach out of the picture altogether. But there are side effects to bariatric surgery. And you can get acid reflux. So if you still have a portion of your stomach, you can definitely get acid reflux. So you have a smaller stomach. There's been trauma to the stomach. There's been trauma to the lower esophageal sphincter. So acid can reflux back up through that stomach and can give you heartburn. There are, of course, risks related to anesthesia. Anesthesia is never 100% safe. If you have someone who knows that they're doing, the risk is low, but things can happen. You can get neurological damage. You can not make it through the surgery. Anesthesia can be dangerous. You can have chronic nausea and vomiting from having bariatric surgery because there's trauma to the digestive system. And also, if your stomach is smaller, your stomach doesn't know how to hold onto the food at the size that it's at. And so you get nausea and vomiting constantly. Your esophagus can be dilated, so you're not going to have as good peristalsis, so it won't function as well. Peristalsis is those rhythmic contractions that get your food through the digestive system. There, you might get more food intolerances. There are certain foods you won't be able to eat, and it may be that you have an immune reaction to them, and it may also be that that the texture of the food, you won't be able to get it down, that you may have to eat softer foods and more liquid foods. If your peristalsis is affected, harder foods like crusty, like bread and things like that, it might be harder to eat, or proteins like animal protein that's harder to chew up and get down because you don't have as good peristalsis to get it down. You can get more infections, especially if you have less stomach acid, if you've curtailed the size of your stomach. One of the things about having a stomach is a stomach makes stomach acid. Remember, the stomach acid's job is to initiate protein digestion. It's to assist in absorbing certain vitamins and minerals like B12, magnesium, calcium, B12, magnesium, calcium, and iron. And so those things are harder to absorb. And hydrochloric acid also disinfects your food. So if you don't have that disinfection happening, you're more likely to have infections from the food. The stomach can become obstructed because if it's been traumatized, the muscles in the stomach might not work as well. So it can become obstructed, especially if it's been curtailed in size or you don't have a stomach anymore. The reason for the bariatric surgery could fail, meaning that you don't lose weight. That can happen. You can also regain weight. I had a relative who had a lap band surgery, and she said people figure out ways to overcome the surgery. And the way that they overcome the surgery is by eating foods that are palatable, that are liquidy or soft. So you can eat, even though it's harder to eat protein like a piece of chicken or turkey or fish, and it's harder to eat fibrous foods like your salad and stuff like that, you can eat ice cream and you can eat pudding and you can eat jam. And those things are slidey and high calorie. You can eat milkshake. You can drink milkshakes. And those things are high calorie, palatable, full of sugar and full of fat and very satisfying. And you can get them down because they taste good and they are not going to, you don't need as much peristalsis to get them down. So people do that and they fail to lose weight or they gain weight. So that's one of the things. There are long-term symptoms of bariatric surgery. One of them is dumping syndrome. You get nausea, dizziness. And so when you eat, you dump whatever's in your system. It all comes out. So you're running for the bathroom with acute diarrhea. So that's dumping syndrome. Dumping syndrome can happen also if you have your gallbladder removed, if you have biliary surgery, especially your gallbladder taken out. Your blood sugar can drop because you don't have the hormones available because you've had your stomach messed with. So you don't have signals to insulin and your secretin and gastrin. You don't have as much of those hormones. And so you don't have insulin. You have an excessive insulin reaction that pulls the sugar out of your blood and your blood sugar goes down too fast. You can be malnourished because, again, if you don't have a stomach or you have a curtailed stomach, remember that the stomach's job is to produce acid for you and help you to absorb certain vitamins and minerals. If you don't have a stomach at all, you might have a problem, for example, producing intrinsic factor. If you don't have parietal cells, you can't make intrinsic factor, and you need intrinsic factor to bond to vitamin B12 along with hydrochloric acid to absorb that vitamin B12 that hooks up in the stomach and then travels through your intestines where it gets absorbed in the terminal ileum being the last part of your small intestine. And so you can get malnutrition in various ways, but mostly to do with the acid, not having as much acid to be available to assist with absorbing of certain vitamins and minerals. You also don't have as much hydrochloric acid to help you with the breakdown of protein. And if you don't have the protein initially broken down, when it gets to your small intestine, it's not denatured enough for the digestive enzymes to act on it. And so you're going to get protein that's poorly digested, and that gets into your intestines, and that can cause infections as well. It can cause infections, and it can cause constipation, and it can cause putrefaction, because the animal protein will kind of rot in your intestines, so that's no good either. Obviously it can cause vomiting because things can get backed up because you have poor peristalsis, so it's going to come back out the way it went in. You can get ulcers because you're going to get irritation of whatever you have, whether it's a smaller stomach or you have part of your intestine functioning as a stomach, and things can get irritated. They can get infected and irritated and dig away at the tissue and become ulcerated. You can also get bowel obstructions, and the bowel obstruction, how that's going to happen is you're not going to have proper peristalsis, so things don't move through the way that they're supposed to. And if you can have an obstruction, because as I said, if you don't have proper hydrochloric acid, when it goes to the small intestine to be acted upon by the brush border enzymes don't act on them as well because it's not broken down enough. So you don't have as good absorption. So things arrive in the in the distal small intestine, the ileum, and into the colon, and they're not properly digested, so your body backs up and you can't get them out. So that can cause obstructions. If you have an infection can cause inflammation in your gut, and inflammation all by itself can cause an obstruction, just because if the lumen, the inside of any part of your small intestine or large intestine closes off, now you have an obstruction. You can get hernias too. And hernias, I think you have to have an existing weak spot in your omentum, in the fascia, the covering, the fat and fluid and fibrous tissue that covers your gut. That's where you get the hernias. If you're more likely to get a hernia, you have to have a tendency to a hernia in order to have a hernia. If you have no hernia thin tissue, you're probably not going to get a hernia. But if you have bloating and you have poor peristalsis and you have spots where things are pooching out, they can press against that thin tissue, and then you can get herniation of the small intestine or large intestine into the abdominal wall. And that can happen in the abdominal wall. It can happen at the navel, and it can happen in the inguinal region, in the crease between your abdomen and your leg. Anywhere you have a weak spot. So that's more likely to happen if you've had bariatric surgery, just because of the peristalsis and the bloating. So the risks vary by the particular procedure. So your surgeon is going to talk to you about these risks. So gastric bypass, which is the ruin why I talked about, where they basically take out your stomach and they make you a little pouch from your small intestine, and you're basically eating into your small intestine, that there are risks there. The hookup can break. The dumping syndrome we already talked about. You can get gallstones, and gallstones in the risk is increased when you have a lot of fat loss and rapidly. Herniation can happen as well. You can get internal bleeding or bleeding at the surgical wound. That can happen with any surgery. You can get leakage. So that's anal leakage. So that if you don't have good peristalsis and you don't have proper digestion of the food as it's going through, it can be liquidy when it comes to the other end. And if you don't have a good functioning peristalsis, including at the end of your anus, you can lose it. And you can get leakage into your abdominal cavity, which can cause peritonitis. And that's the next thing on here, perforation of the stomach or intestines. Your pouch can become obstructed. That's the place that they, when they do the Roux-en-Y, but that little pouch can become obstructed. You can get protein or calorie malnutrition. You may just not be able to eat enough. You can get pulmonary or cardiac problems because you're malnourished, and the pulmonary problems would happen because if you're getting reflux, you can aspirate the reflux, and that can get into your lungs, and that can cause pneumonia. Great. Skin separation. So that will happen. That's just because you've had surgery, and that's a risk of any surgery. Or injury to other organs. So if you have leakage, you can have irritation and inflammation to adjacent organs. So the spleen is one of the organs that can get injured. You can get an ulceration in the stomach. We talked about that. You can get a stricture. If you have a stricture, can happen because you have a lot of scar tissue, scar tissue from the surgery and irritation. So the scar tissue happens, and then your esophagus or your intestines are trying to do peristalsis and they get stuck. And so you have a thin spot and stuff can't get through, which will lead to more obstructions. They say vitamin or iron. We already talked about the deficiency. You can decrease the risk by making sure you do lose weight, increasing exercise, not smoking. So those are basically the risks of bariatric surgery. Now, we should talk about the benefits of bariatric surgery, because, you know, I'm not going to just tell you, oh, you shouldn't get bariatric surgery if you've made a decision that bariatric surgery is what you're going to do. I think that's okay, because people do it and they do have success. They successfully lose weight and it does help people. So you can't say it's all bad, because all the side effects are there, just that side effects. Just because I'm listing them off doesn't mean that you're going to get them. So what are the benefits of bariatric surgery? Let's see. It has benefits and risk. If you're not morbidly obese, so if your bariatric surgery is really best for people who are morbidly obese, that means you have a BMI greater than 30, probably 40 or greater even. It's the risks, the benefits start to outweigh the risks. The risks outweigh the benefits when you're below that. And so when they say morbidly obese is not a number, it doesn't tell you what BMI, I don't know what they're considering, because my understanding of how you measure obesity is that there's class 1 obesity, which is a BMI. So BMI is your body mass index, and that's a function of your height versus your weight, which doesn't really tell you anything about, doesn't really tell you about your muscle mass. And so body mass index is just a function of height and weight. And you can be, you can have a lot of body fat and be definitely be obese, or you can be that lovely woman who played rugby and she has a BMI of over 30 and she's very solid. She has a lot of muscle mass. And she's class 1 obese because her BMI is over 30. But But she doesn't have a lot of body fat. So it really doesn't function as a measure of her health. And if you go on TikTok and Facebook and Instagram, you'll see her talking about that. All right. So So if you have a very high BMI, you're going to do better. Your benefits outweigh your risks. But if you have a lower BMI, so if you're merely overweight or you're in the low 30s, it's not going to be as beneficial, and you really should look at other means to lose weight. So when you lose weight, as soon as you lose weight, most people lose a lot of weight rapidly and lose weight for 18 to 36 weeks. So that's going to be over the better part of a year. Your health, there are obesity-related health conditions that will improve, like diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, sleep apnea, all these things improve. And people often find that if they're on medications for their cholesterol or blood pressure, and this is something I could consider too, if I would try to lose weight, maybe my blood pressure would come down. So I would actually have to actively try to do that. And if I could do that, and that might benefit me. Although my mother is not overweight and her blood pressure is high, she's also 84 years old. My sister is, and so she takes the med. So diabetes can be corrected. High blood pressure can come down. Cholesterol can come down. And if you have sleep apnea, where you're waking up in the middle of the night and not breathing, that can be improved. Your quality of life after you have the bariatric surgery, it can improve your patient's overall mood, your psychological health, and people who undergo these procedures have less depression and anxiety and increase in energy, and they can be more active. There are some people who have bariatric surgery and it is the best thing that they ever do. And you can see testimonials of them if you look on the internet. And you can see patient stories and they'll tell you about how their bariatric surgery did really wonderful things for them. So it's really something to consider. So bariatric surgery, you have to weigh the pros and cons. And what you should do is, if that's something you're really thinking about, you get somebody who specializes in bariatric surgery, and that's mostly what they do. And they're going to know all the pros and cons for you, and they're going to be able to help you with a lot of things around it. Water break. Time to drink water. Always time to drink water. Yes. Okay. So there you go. All right. Let's start talking about the GLP-1 agonists. All right. So GLP-1 agonists, here's what's up with them. So they can help manage blood sugar levels, reduce your appetite, support your weight loss, but they're not appropriate for everyone, and you're not guaranteed to have them covered by insurance. So these are medications known as glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonists, GLP-1 agonists. They're very popular. They have a great ability to help manage blood sugar levels and reduce hunger and food intake and potentially support weight loss. The medications, which include Ozempic and Zepbound, aren't for everyone, can be pretty expensive. And if you have to pay for them out of pocket, they can be quite expensive. So as with other medications, there are generic and brand names for these GLP-1 medications. So most of them, a lot of them are semaglutide. So Wegovy, Ozempic, Rybelsus are all the same thing, are all semaglutide. And Wegovy and Ozempic you inject, and Rybelsus you take a pill. But they're all the same drug, semaglutide. Then there's tirzepatide. Tirzepatide is Mounjaro and Zepbound. And they're also a once weekly injection. Then there's liraglutide. And liraglutide, I believe, is just a pill because it says once daily. So imagine you're not going to inject yourself every day. That's probably a pill as well. So that's your Saxenda and Victoza. That's liraglutide. Then Trulicity is an injectable that you inject weekly. That's dulaglutide. And then there's Byetta, which is exenatide, which you take twice a day. Again, I'm imagining that's also a pill. And then Bydureon, which is also an extended release form of Exenatide, same as Byetta. So that's an injectable that you do once a week. So those are all the names of the drugs. So how they work. So here's a breakdown of how they work. They work on your brain. They help to reduce your appetite and increase your satiety. So actually, let me see if... So one of the things is some of these are the, some of these GIPs. So the GLP-1s. So GLP-1s also decrease your risk of heart attack. They decrease your risk of cardiovascular death. The liver, they improve your insulin sensitivity. They make you more sensitive to insulin throughout your body. So if you have more insulin sensitivity throughout your body, insulin's going to bond to your cells and let the sugar come into your cells for usage. So it's going to get burned up instead of sitting in your blood and either being turned into triglycerides to affect your cardiovascular state or being shunted by insulin to be stored as fat. So if you have more insulin sensitivity, you're more likely to use your glucose, get it out of your blood and so that it is not stored. So it doesn't go into the storage form in your blood, which is triglycerides, or the storage form in your fat cells that's your more adipose tissue that where you have fat storage. Then your digestion, your GI tract, what it does is it decreases stomach emptying and decreases GI motility. So your stomach doesn't empty as fast. So it's probably not a good idea for someone who has gastroparesis. So if you have gastroparesis, I think that's contraindication to these drugs because it does slow your stomach emptying and it increases your GI motility. So you feel full sooner and the food goes through your system more slowly. And I wonder if it goes through your system too slowly, you're going to have food that's not broken down as well. And when it gets to the other end, then you can have digestive problems. It decreases glucagon secretion. So glucagon is another hormone that puts sugar into your blood. So if you have less glucagon, less sugar goes into your blood, which means it's going to lower your blood sugar. That's why it's good for diabetes. It increases insulin secretion. So you have more insulin around, but that's okay because you're sensitive to it. So you're going to bond that insulin and the sugar is going to go into your cells. And in terms of adipose tissue, in your fat tissue, it's going to increase your insulin sensitivity. So insulin's going to bond there. And so when it bonds there, you're going to tend to burn fat more and increases fat this is GIP. So it blocks gastric inhibitory peptide. It's also going to decrease stomach acid secretion and then, no, I'm reading about GIP. GIP is not, that's not the direction you want to go. That's not what these drugs do. So it blocks those effects. So it blocks the effects of GIP, gastric inhibitory peptide. So it decreases appetite and GIP would increase your insulin sensitivity. The GLP-1 is going to increase your insulin sensitivity and the GIP increases your fat metabolism and storage. You are going to have less stomach acid secretion from the GLP-1. So again, that's another way that it interferes with your digestion. So if you have less stomach acid secretion, you're not going to have as well disinfected food. You're not going to be able to absorb things like iron, vitamin B12, calcium, magnesium, you're also not going to be able to disinfect your food as well. And you're not going to be able to initiate protein digestion as well. The protein that doesn't get properly denatured is going to wind up not being digested well in your digestive tract and it's wind up in your intestines and give you digestive upset, gas, bloating, diarrhea, stuff like that. So Ozempic and Wegovy exclusively bind to GLP-1 receptors. That's the your semaglutide, and Mounjaro and Zepbound, which are Mounjaro and Zepbound are tirzepatide, also binds to GIP-1, the gastric inhibitory polypeptide, and also GLP-1. So they were originally used to treat type 2 diabetes, But researchers were noticing that they seemed to decrease appetite and promote weight loss, so they began studying them as direct weight loss medications. Wegovy and Ozempic, they're the same drug, but Wegovy was specifically approved as a weight loss drug, and Ozempic is actually meant to treat type 2 diabetes, but it is prescribed for weight loss as well. And doctors try to prescribe these alongside other interventions like reducing your calories, getting exercise, and reducing your other means to take away your to lower your blood sugar. So the GLP-1 and GLP-GIP medications have been shown to be effective for managing blood sugar and reducing body weight, but they have to be paired with other lifestyle changes. Tirzepatide is possibly more effective than injectable semaglutide. And weight regain is common if you stop taking the GLP-1 medications. This is what Jillian Michaels was talking about. Once you stop, you're probably going to gain the weight back. And the other thing is, because it causes you to lose muscle tissue, you don't have as much muscle tissue. So when you lose the weight, when you regain the weight, you're going to regain most of it as fat, and you may have lost muscle tissue that you already had. So due to promising research, Wegovy was recently approved by the FDA for reducing the risk of heart attacks and stroke people with a higher risk of those. I'm not personally going to take it. But anyway, so there was a study in 2022 where they found people with type 2 diabetes that tirzepatide was effective at reducing body weight, improving blood sugar management, and altering levels of substances associated with type 2 diabetes. And a review in 2017 found that GLP-1 medications were slightly more effective than insulin for lowering hemoglobin A1C levels. That's the measure of the damage to cells as a result of high blood sugar. Some GLP-1 medications may be more effective than others when it comes to blood sugar and weight management in people with type 2 diabetes. And there was a 2018 study that found that Ozempic was more effective than Trulicity and Victoza, that's dulaglutide and liraglutide, and improving blood sugar management and body weight. And you have to realize that you have to watch out that these studies were funded by pharmaceutical companies, so they really want you to take the drugs. So that's where I'm going to leave off here. We'll start next week talking about research on the GLP-1 medications, and then I'll tell you about how I help my patients with weight loss. And, you know, I try to do it without it. Now, patients are throwing up their arms, I can't do anything. I'm like, well, maybe you should consider getting those medications. I, of course, can't prescribe them, so I have to send them somewhere where they can get them. But meanwhile, I talk to them about the usual stuff, and you'll hear what that is next week. All right, so I am going to sign off now because it's about that time. So you have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live and Instagram Live episode at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.